Someone asked me before the service, it was Bob Ellis, what this image was, and I forgot because I chose it a long time ago, but it dawned on me that it's actually the women going to the tomb after Jesus' crucifixion and carrying all the healing ointments and the stone in front of the tomb. But the story that we have today of the Canaanite woman, the unidentified, unnamed Canaanite woman, is very much a story of resurrection, the resurrection of her child. And as I was reflecting on this passage throughout the week, I was caught up in the argument between the Pharisees and the scribes and Jesus about washing their hands. I was reminded of my childhood table where somebody was always ratting somebody out for not washing their hands before they came to the table. But the stakes were much higher in the argument between the Pharisees and scribes and Jesus. And throughout this time, with the woman coming in and shouting, being shouted down by the disciples who want to disappear her, and Jesus, who apparently was not having a good day because he wasn't being like Jesus that we think of, the little girl kept peeking out from behind the words at me, trying to get my attention. And I began to focus on her as the origin of this story and of the consequences to her and children like her, who are not fairly represented, who do not have advocates, and who the powers that be are not listening to. So let us bring the children into this room, our children, the children inside of us, the children in the world, here as we reflect on this story. And earlier, I had on my stole that's made for me with beads of things found in the desert, and particularly things of children. Let us remember the children that are making their way from afar through the desert, on the tops of train, across water. No parent chooses to drag their child across the Mediterranean Sea or across the desert, or on the top of a train. No parent chooses to leave a child in a detention center for unaccompanied minors. Let us remember all the children as we engage in the arguments of the grown-ups in today's story. It's very fitting that we're talking about the Canaanite woman because March 8th, Wednesday, was the International Day of the woman. And in Mexico, where I served for 8 years, that was a really big deal. The nuns would go to the bishop where they would ask for permission to have a pilgrimage, which was really a protest march, but they weren't going to say that to the bishop. And they would come with their signs protesting all the things that oppressed women, and also with signs that celebrated all the ways that women were rising. The first Women's Day was held on February 28, 1909, in New York City by the Socialist Party. Did you know that? It's a communist thing. And actually was celebrated in communist countries until 1975, when the United Nations declared it an International Day of Women. But then in 1917, on March 8th, in Petrograd, which was the capital of the Russian Empire, a demonstration of women textile workers began, covering the entire city, so that, if only this could happen today, 7 days later, the Emperor of Russia, Nicholas II, abdicated. And the provisional government granted women the right to vote. Think about it. How exciting is that? That after the Women's March, that so many men and women, all kinds of people participated in, that things would actually change at that level, and we have to have faith that they are changing at some levels that we can't even imagine. It's a timely telling of this story today of the courage and commitment and faith of the unnamed Canaanite woman in Matthew's gospel. In Mark's gospel, she's called the Syrophoenician woman. Both titles are denigrating. Both titles show the antipathy that Jews of that day had toward the Gentiles and toward a woman that would break in completely unannounced and uninvited in a man's inner sanctum, which is what she did. Today's gospel story is revealed like a two-act play with Jesus as the central character. The title of the play could have come directly from Matthew's text. It's not what goes into your mouth that defiles, it's what comes out of it. Friends, I think this is the new poster that we have in the next march. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles, it's what comes out of it. The first act is Jesus teaching to the large crowd that he's called together, his congregation. Then, and in Matthew's time, which was some 90 years after Jesus was born, and in our day, the second act depicts Jesus pulling away from the crowd, as he often did, just to teach his disciples. It was like an itinerant seminary where the disciples would get a teaching with the whole crowd, and then Jesus would pull away to have a moment, a teaching moment with them, where they could do and say stupid things, right, but not be in the presence of other people and be thoroughly embarrassed by that. Sometimes we, when we're unpacking our notions and privilege, we need to pull away where we can grapple with what we're doing and take another step forward in our understanding of what privilege looks like. The context in Matthew's gospel reading for today is wedged in between the stories of the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. Oh yeah, plus women and children, the text tells us. So probably 10,000 or more people, 8,000 or more people. This text of a lack of radical hospitality is wedged into two texts of radical hospitality. First, with mostly Jews, and the food, the table is spread out of the baskets of all the people who had come, and there was plenty of food and even leftovers, which the woman in today's story wants a few of those crumbs. And then we have this story, and it's like our faith story, right? We go along, we're doing pretty well, we're feeding the people, we feel pretty good about ourselves, and then we do something stupid or mean or excluding, and if we're lucky, we kind of go, oh, duh, and we get a chance to do it over again. And in this particular story, Jesus actually learned from the Canaanite woman. Because at the end of Matthew's gospel, Jesus calls the disciples to go out to them, where he formerly had said, don't go there. Don't go there to the Gentiles. This woman taught Jesus something. So just when we think we've got it as Christians and we're really self-righteous and we're a great church that does all of these things, we still have lots more to learn. So the context of the story is that Jesus and his disciples are not washing their hands before meals. These purity codes were meant for people traveling through the wilderness, people who didn't have sanitation and refrigeration, and it was about the community's well-being. That's why these rules were first put in place. You don't go potty inside your encampment. You go outside the camp to go potty. You wash your hands before you eat, right? You don't spill your seed all over the place, because we need to raise up children. We need to take care of our reproduction. But times change, needs change. Science comes in, context change, and the rules need to change, but there's still some of those people who say, this is the way we did it, this is our tradition, it's so important to us. When there are people at the door saying, hello, Yoo-hoo, I don't find myself there. That doesn't matter to me. Matthew's community was made up of Jews who had grown up thoroughly Jewish. They knew all the purity codes. They knew the rituals of cleansing. They knew all of those rules. But they were messianic Jews. They had begun to, they were disaffected Jews. They were falling away from traditional Judaism, and they were following Jesus. And Matthew's community also had these Gentiles who were a part of the community. You can imagine if you've ever experienced two churches coming together to become one new church, there's all kinds of turf wars about what, you know, what kinds of things are we going to have up here on the table, and what kind of goblet are we going to use and plate, and what prayers are we going to say, and what songs are we going to sing, because we did it in our church that way, right? So that's what was going on in Matthew's community. So in talking about the Canaanite woman, Matthew stirs a pot that his listeners would remember because of this historical rift between the Jews and the Gentiles. Not necessarily between the Gentiles and the Jews, mind you, but the Jews definitely having a thing against the Gentiles. And Jesus in chapter 5 has told his disciples when he first sends them out, don't go to the Gentiles. Go to the lost sheep of Israel. Don't go to the Gentiles. But in today's story, it says that Jesus turns to enter Tyre and Sidon, which were primarily Gentile territory. He's probably exhausted, who knows, but he's with the men gathered around, and they're maybe having a beer, I don't know, they're relaxing a little bit, and suddenly this woman barges in, and the text tells us that she yells, have mercy on me, have pity on me. She sees Jesus. She gets who he is. Even though she's not a card-carrying member of the club, she recognizes him. The text doesn't tell us that Jesus has been to Tyre and Sidon, so we don't know how she's heard about what he's done and who he is, but she sees some light in him. And she, a woman gone mad with the suffering of her child, breaks into that room and she yells, have mercy on me, my child is filled with demons and is suffering. Have mercy on me and my child. Kyrie eleison is what she says, and that is ritualistic words that have carried down through the centuries in the Christian church. Lord, have mercy. The disciples' response is anything but that. They say, get rid of her. She keeps shouting at us. Get rid of her. Disappear her. Get rid of her. And Jesus doesn't act. And Jesus responds and says, look, I'm not here. I'm supposed to be, if they're crumbs that fall from the tables, therefore the lost sheep of Israel. And she says, even the dog, she gets down on her knees. And I don't think she's yelling at this point. And she says again, have mercy on me. Even the dogs get the crumbs that fall from the table. We have here a woman with her nonviolent act of resistance who stands her ground, who protests, who talks to Jesus as an equal, who refuses to be put in her place, who defends the rights of her daughter to live, to achieve her God-given potential. And Jesus finally gets it. And he says, he applauds her for her faith, and her daughter is healed. Now, whatever that means, but if you think metaphorically and you back away from this play, we can imagine what kind of demons our children have. They have the demons of poverty. They have the demons of addiction in the family. They have the demons of war and violence. They have the demons of discrimination, of prejudice. They have the demons of sexism that holds them back, of lack of education and health care. They have all kinds of demons that don't allow them to live out their God-given potential, and every day children die because of decisions that are made in that upper room, in that inner circle, because we are not listening to the parents that are desperate to save their children. I once found a spoon in the desert, a little spoon that you get, a silver spoon, when your baby's born, and it had the name engraved. It was a Spanish name. And I took it to a friend of mine who was an artist, and she made an altar, and it said, "How far would you walk to feed your child?" We have a story today of two different kinds of stubbornness. One of hard-hearted, hard-headed, clenched fist, because the disciples were too tired, because the Pharisees and the scribes were scared about changes, because women weren't allowed in that kind of a situation, because. And we have the parent who breaks in and shouts for their attention. Friends, today, the parents are shouting for our attention. What kind of stubbornness will we have as church? I pray that we as individuals, as church, as a nation, and as a world, continue to unclench, to soften, to make space, to hear and see those children and their need, and do something to help them achieve their God-given potential. May it be so. Amen.